Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Know the Faith, Defend the Faith. My name is William Hemsworth. It's great to be with you all today. I'm really honored to have my guest, Eric Ibarra. Check out his website, ericibarra.org. He's done a lot of great work, fantastic apologist. Check out his blog. He deep dives into many subjects. Eric, it's a pleasure to have you on today. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. I'm just humbled by your introduction. I'm happy to be here and appreciate your work as well. We're both blessed to have each other.
Oh, well, amen. So I asked you to come on today because you've done a lot of work in the area of Eastern Orthodoxy and, of course, the papacy. So I wanted to talk about the differences between our Eastern Orthodox friends and us as Roman Catholics. But before we do that, can you maybe go over maybe what some of the similarities are for those that maybe aren't familiar?
Yes, yeah. So, you know, so what may be very familiar with your listeners is that when we look back to Christian history, we recognize that throughout the first 12 centuries, roughly, Christendom was largely united. And, you know, that led up to the famous Greek and Latin schism, symbolically dated to 1054. But certainly that's a rough date. But, you know, Catholics speak about the one and the one undivided church of the first millennium. And so Eastern Orthodox and Catholics, we look back at that shared patrimony where we were both linked together in one bond of communion, one bond of peace. And so we share a huge line of beliefs, and we also share a historical lineage and an apostolic lineage back to the Church of Jerusalem, which, you know, was created on the day of Pentecost. And so, you know, the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Catholic churches were both apostolic churches. You know, we've elucidated that in recent history with the Second Vatican Council and Lumen Gentium document talking about the nature of the church, the calling and vocation of the church, but also our relationship with those who are close to us by many bonds. And so even though the Orthodox Church, the Catholic Church today, we don't enjoy the same union we had in the first millennium, we do share a massive patrimony. The seven ecumenical councils, for example, both of those confessions, decrees, and canons are both equally cherished by East and West. And we also share the pedigree of the church fathers all the way up to, and sometimes even past, that symbolic date of 1054. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a calendar of saints that are pretty much the same when it comes to the popular doctors, martyrs, and mystics of the past. We both believe in the seven sacraments. We both believe in the authority of the visible church, the singularity of the church. We both believe that the church has been equipped and authorized to teach the gospel to the nations. All questions of doctrine need to be pointed back towards the church to answer definitively. So we share a lot. I mean, we can go on and on. But, you know, for your listeners, you know, it would be a good idea if you haven't already to visit one of these churches, these Orthodox churches. If you haven't already visited an Eastern Catholic, you know, Byzantine Rite Church or Ukrainian Rite, there's all kinds of different Eastern Rite churches in the Catholic communion. But yeah, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, definitely. And for anyone out there, I do recommend you visit one of the Eastern Rites. It's absolutely beautiful and stunning. You'll definitely be blessed by it. So what exactly happened in 1054?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because today, when we look at the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, ecumenical dialogue really centers in on the papacy, on the nature of the papal office. And that seems to harbor the most controversy today in our dialogue. However, If you go back in time, for example, in the 15th century, the debate was largely on the filioque doctrine. But going back to 1054, that symbolic date, it wasn't even the filioque substantially. What really created the fracture between Rome and Constantinople in 1054 were some preliminary letters that went back and forth about the use of the use of enzymes in the baking of bread for Holy Communion. So the Western churches, probably somewhere around the 8th, 9th century, we can't be absolutely certain when we started this, but instead of using leavened bread, we began using unleavened bread, so flattened hosts. Right. And the Eastern churches, the Greek churches, when they got notice of that, it seems as though either they were confused about it and didn't write too much about it, or they simply thought it was a different custom. But when there was reason to bring this up as a matter of controversy, the Greeks accused the Latin ritual of a heretical sacrament. Basically, using unleavened bread subtracted from the essence of the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist. And so they accused the Latin churches of defecting that sacrament. And so they even said it wasn't a real sacrament because it had to be leavened. So, you know, you've got a number of churchmen writing letters back and forth, and that led, and there were some other accusations about Latin customs, fasting on Saturdays, using milk and cheese during Lent, other issues that obviously they would have known instantaneously if they had inter-global instant communication like we have today. Right. But back then, because you had the, you know, division of the empires, the West rose, the Byzantine Empire kind of went more eastward, communication wasn't as instant. So a lot of these things were not panned out instantaneously. But when knowledge came to the surface enough for that controversy, that's really what sparked the debate. And so that's when Pope Leo IX sent legates, one of which was the famous Cardinal Humbert Candida. And that led to, you know, a fiasco in the city of Constantinople. And, you know, yes, the Humbert did accuse the Greeks of not having the filioque in the creed. So there were some other accusations going on, but what really led up to that issue was the enzymes, the use of enzymes in the Holy Eucharist. They would call the Latins derogatorily the enzymists. So, you know, that was the first official term condemning the West. Then there was the filioquists, and then today the papists. But it really started off as an enzymite issue.
Fascinating. Never heard that. That's very interesting how it started off with just that.
Yeah. Wow. It's not really, you know, it's what's interesting is the Orthodox don't really bring that up today.
I've never heard it ever.
No, I've spoken to some of the English speaking, some of the world's experts in the English literature in canon, Eastern Orthodox canon law. And they've even said it's kind of a dead issue today. So it doesn't seem like much the Orthodox really make that big of a deal of it anymore.
Okay. Now you mentioned two things, the filioque and the papacy. Are those the two main things separating us today?
Yes, absolutely. So the Orthodox Church right now today, there's, you know, a number of issues. There's more than the papacy and the filioque, but those two things take up the most space in the dialogue. And then the filioque opens up two further issues. The question of the theological correctness of saying that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, and secondly, whether the Latin West was duly authorized to add filioque to the creed, which is a more of a disciplinary question. So the filioques got a dual problem for the Orthodox. For the papacy, they reject papal infallibility, and they reject the ordinariness, the immediateness, and the directness of papal jurisdiction of the Bishop of Rome. So those are really that's the powerhouse problem today.
Okay. Now, as far as the papacy goes, you mentioned some of the issues that the Orthodox may have with it. Can you tell us exactly how they view the papacy?
Yeah, this is, it really takes a long time to really get into all the details. So sure. I'm just going to try and give the helicopter view of the forest here. The Eastern churches were all aware that the Church of Rome was the head of the church, you know, the head of all the churches. That's kind of unavoidable because the ecumenical councils refer to the Pope as the head of the universal church. So the Eastern churches today, they're not as unified on this question, you know. So you can talk to a theologian in Russia under the Moscow Patriarchate, and they're going to have a very different critique of the papacy than if you were to go to the Patriarchate of Constantinople, for example. But they're all united in rejecting the idea that out of the apostles, Christ singled out Saint Peter and gave him a discriminate supremacy. So a unique authority, the nature of which is jurisdictional, immediate, and over the whole church. So they would opt for something far less in nature and degree, you know. So sure, you know, like the Russian churches, they say, yeah, Rome was the first church of the first millennium, but they held a primacy of honor only. And so, you know, the Pope being a primus inter pares, meaning he shares the same vocation as every other bishop. But there's this added layer of honor, which is really not, in essence, one of authority, but there's certain memorial honor that goes to Rome for several reasons. You know, it was the capital of the Oikoumeni, the Roman Empire. And so the church being part of, you know, the church at one point came so united to the empire that the church started to adopt many of the geopolitical structures of the Roman Empire. So, you know, Rome had that historical, prestige. Also, Peter and Paul were the Saints Peter and Paul. They shed their blood in that city and so sanctified the Church of Rome and they're like the duo primates of the apostles. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they find these extra layers of reasons to put Rome in an honorific position, but that position is not some sort of sacro-juridical authority over the rest of the church. See, so I think that, you know, however diverse the Orthodox critiques are today, they would reject that he has a primacy of jurisdictional authority. He has a primacy of honor, maybe with some canonical privileges that are not the same for everyone, but it's regulated by the canons. It's regulated by a church constitution. It's not something where the Pope has divine right to judge and lead the church.
Okay. So how would they interpret Matthew 16:18, for example?
Yeah. So I mean that varies too. If we speak with some of the more scholarly Orthodox theologians today, I think they would have no problem in finding that Saint Peter, for example, is the rock of the church. So in some sense, Peter holds this supporting function to the church. It's kind of like a foundation to a building. But they may put emphasis more on the faith of Peter being what causes that rockiness. And so the faith and the man are divisible. And so perhaps, you know, there is this primacy given to Peter, but that doesn't mean Peter has some sort of unique prerogative in the apostles. And so, yeah, he could be called the rock because of his confession of faith. In terms of the keys of the kingdom, the Orthodox typically understand that Peter received the keys of the kingdom simply as the first in an order of equal series. So kind of like a serial primacy. He received it first in the series, but then the apostles received the keys, and then the bishops received the keys. And, you know, to some extent, even presbyters, priests use the keys. So they don't see the keys as some sort of like a singular authority in relation to the church. They would kind of see the keys as kind of like a corporate authority that you get, that every bishop has, every apostle has. And so decisions have to come, you know, when it comes to final decision making, for example, it has to be all of the, it has to be everyone's input, or some majority of the, you know, some moral majority giving the input, rather than one man, you know,
okay,
having a final ratification.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, to the filioque, I know that's a whole deep subject, which can, you know, we spend hours on, but I guess obviously we say Holy Spirit proceeds through the Father and the Son. Is there a theological issue with that the Orthodox have, or is it more of the who gave the authority for that to be added?
So the filioque is a very thorny problem. Really what it comes down to is, yes, it does come down to a matter of authority. There were saints in the first millennium who understood that, that the church at least had the authority to add to the creed. But that, you know, that was not the unanimous view. You had some folks who really thought that the church at the second ecumenical council, but really at the third and fourth ecumenical councils, put sort of like a permanent lock on the creed. And so especially for the Greeks in the East, the Byzantine churches, the creed had a permanent lock on it. But that seems to not have been the interpretation of the Latin West, because we see it as early as the 6th century at the Council of Toledo in 589. They do add filioque to the Nicene Constantinopolitan Creed. And so in the West, at least since the 6th century, the creed was, you know, if it was recited or if it was talked about in catechetical instructions, it had the filioque. And you know, it was so much so in the you know, Frankish realm and the Germanic realm, in Spain, for example, they all over time they all thought that the original creed had the filioque. It was so embedded into the Latin West, for example, so that by the time you reach the 9th century with Photius, the Latins farther west than Rome, they thought the filioque was original. Of course, they were wrong. You know, the Greeks were right that filioque was added. Rome took a middle position, defending the orthodoxy of the filioque. So the filioque is correct in doctrine. But Rome, all the way up until the 10th century, held that the creed should not have the filioque. So there was, in other words, you had Rome and then some other Western churches that you know, the Western churches wanted to keep the filioque in the creed, but Rome didn't allow it. So that created a middle position, and the Eastern churches for a time, as long as the filioque was not in the creed, It seems as though they were willing to entertain this modus vivendi, a sort of toleration of the acceptance of the doctrine, but as long as it's not in the creed. But eventually, in the 10th century, probably 1014, was a papal coronation mass of King Henry II, I believe. Filioque was recited in the creed for the very first time in Rome. And since then, around that time, the Eastern churches accused the Latins of breaking the law of the church, because the law forbade any additions to the creed. Of course, the West would respond and say that, you know, this is a discipline, you know, it's not an essential piece of doctrine. The creed, the construction of the creed itself was a gradual development. You have changes in the creed from the Synod of Constantinople 381 to the Synod of Chalcedon in 451. The Nicene Creed in 325 was even different than what the Greeks cite today in their divine liturgies. So the West thought that the Pope had the authority to unlock the creed and add filioque to it, and also defend its doctrine. So that was kind of the last straw for the Greeks, okay. You know. And so they both, you know, up to this day, dispute the theological correctness of the filioque. And they also believe that the West violated the law of the church. And so the Catholic West is the one that is responsible for the schism.
Okay. What would have to happen in regard to the filioque for there to be unity?
Wow. So that's a good question. So right now, any question on what has to be done for the unity of the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church would first involve the Eastern Orthodox coming to a consolidated view on anything.
That's going to be my next question.
Because right now, it takes a lot for the Orthodox churches to come to an agreement on questions of doctrine, questions of church law. The evidence of that is in the recent Council of Crete in 2016. They were not able to manage an ecumenical council or a pan-Orthodox council. So what must be done for unity on the filioque really requires the Eastern churches to collaborate amongst themselves on what they would accept, because right now the Patriarch of Constantinople, he's very open to unity with the Catholic Church, and in fact it's reported that when he was on Mount Athos recently, he said there is no doctrinal barrier to the union between East and West. Now, if you ask, you know, the Patriarch of Georgia, if you ask the Patriarch of Moscow, Kirill, you know, you're going to get a different answer. And so, but I would say that if we can show that by our doctrine of the filioque, we are not sacrificing the monarchic singularity of the Father, that the Father is the sole arche, he's the sole beginning, the sole origin of the tripersonal unity of the Trinity, then we should have no problem with the, you know, unity with the Orthodox Church. But there's so many layers of doctrinal significance to this, yeah. It would be impossible to scope it out. But, I you know, the main issue is they think that the filioque turns the Father into a dyad with the Son. And so the Son and the Father become sort of like two principles in the Godhead. And you can't have two principles in the Godhead because God is one. You know, God has to have that singularity. So they think we've committed a very serious error when it comes to theology proper. But I think our theologians always, you know, back since St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Anselm, St. Bonaventure, several of our theologians have shown that not only is our doctrine patristic, but it doesn't fall victim to their criticism. So I think that, you know, we're really going to have to hash that doctrinal issue out. Now, the Greeks agreed at the Council of Florence in our resolution of the Filioque. We showed that it was in the Church Fathers and that it has a doctrinal coherence. And the Greeks agreed. Now, obviously, that's another thorny issue on the Council of Florence. The Greeks ended up rejecting that. So they at once rejected it, but later on, they said the conditions for agreement were not sincere, they were not sufficient. And so they ended up annulling that council for their end. You know, but for us, it's an ecumenical council. So I think we've done all the work of showing that the Filioque is 100% innocent. So it's going to take, I think that the Orthodox are going to have to really incline their ear more on that problem.
Yeah. Okay. How about with the papacy? What has to be done there?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there are some legitimate complaints, I think, from the Orthodox on the papacy. And that's really due to historical accidents. So following the Gregorian reforms in the, you know, we're talking about after, you know, in between the 10th and the 12th centuries, there was a gradual development with the authority of the papal office. And it was really because of what's called the investiture controversy in the West. You had local kings, local lords, and local princes that, because they had ownership of property, they felt like they could regulate ecclesiastical affairs, choose their own priests, choose their own bishops. And so this severely weakened the Church of the West. And so the only answer to that was to augment the authority of the Pope and to make certain new disciplines that would require intense papal supervision. And in order to avoid the secularization of the church. And so this kind of molded the papacy in a much more overarching supervisory role. Instead of, you know, in the past, the papacy was like the last court of appeals, sort of like a watchman, you know, like sort of looking from afar and making sure that the church is all right. Whenever there's a serious problem, then the papacy gets involved, right? But that changed with the Gregorian reforms. So now that there was all these kind of papal regulations in the everyday life of the church. And that's not necessary. You know, that's not really necessary. So I think the papacy could dial back and, you know, retain all of its doctrine about its universal jurisdiction, universal primacy, everything that Vatican I says, but dial it back to what it used to be, which is a last court of appeal. Mm-hmm. So that way we're respecting the full responsibility of patriarchs, archbishops, metropolitans, and they can sort of be more free to handle their own internal affairs. Whenever something can't be resolved on a local level, then it should get kicked up to a higher level and if it can't be resolved on a regional level, then and only should it be kicked up to the highest Supreme Court, which is the Pope. So I think if we were to dial back to that format, that would really go a long way for the Orthodox.
Do you think we'll see it in our lifetime?
Well, I don't. And here's why. Because even with dialing back, like I just said, they still disagree with the constitutional theory that Christ took Peter, gave him these authority. So they really don't mind Rome being like the final court, but it has to be mutually regulated. You know, like if we permit, you know, if the churches permit the case to be brought to Rome, or if they invite Rome, you know, and they would probably have problems with saying that the whole orchestra is of divine institution. They would say it's not really divine institution. It's more of an ecclesiastical institution, something that the church created later. And, you know, it's good for managing the affairs of the house, economy of the house, but it's not something like doctrinal, divinely instituted, and something that we have to believe. So I think even if we dialed back like I described, they're still going to quibble with the constitutional theory. And especially with Moscow and Constantinople being at odds, we who are we going to, I mean, Russia is the largest populated Orthodox church in the world. And their theory is that the Pope is not a last court of appeal. He's only a primate of honor. I mean, they really shaved it down to just mere honor. For Constantinople, the Bishop of Rome has canonical jurisdiction, but not on the same constitutional theory. So there's still a lot of differences, and in our lifetime, it would take a miracle. And of course, God can do that, but I don't see it happening.
Now, just one more question. Is it possible for, like, Constantinople, for instance, to come into full communion while the other ones are not?
Yeah, I mean, it's happened, you know, similar things have happened before like that. You know, Constantinople came into communion with Rome at the Union of Florence, for example. That union lasted in Constantinople for about 20 years. But the other patriarchs did not recognize it. So right now you have 14 autocephalous heads of the Eastern Orthodox Church. If one of them entered into union with Rome, one possibility is that the other 13 just remove that patriarch from the union of churches, and they may, you know, try to get a pan-Orthodox synod to establish a new bishopric, or you know, the lawful successor of Constantinople, and then you'd have sort of two bishops side by side in Constantinople, the one that's still in communion with the 14. And then the other one in communion with Rome. So that happens. It has happened before. So it's certainly possible. You know, if Constantinople did that, it is likely that he they it wouldn't be alone. I think there would be some other churches that would also do it. But it would definitely be a schism. It would definitely be a schism.
Okay. Let's switch gears for a second. In the introduction, I forgot to mention your work with Reason and Theology. My apologies for that. I don't know how I forgot. It's my favorite YouTube channel. But
Thank you.
so what's going on over there? What are you guys working on?
Well, yeah. So you know, Reason and Theology is it, you know, it's grown a lot. I have actually been absent recently because I've actually returned to full-time school, and so I have less time to be on. I am scheduled to be on again. But Michael Lofton's kind of taking the helm of the boat there, the ship there, and he's doing well. I mean, he's doing a lot of work on the magisterium. He's doing his doctoral dissertation on magisterial how to test magisterial documents. So he's really going in that direction. But you know, we still have a whole host of interviews from varying different perspectives. And so check it out. You'll see. And of course, you know, admittedly, there does seem to be sort of an emphasis on East-West relationship. So, you know, we don't really deal too much with like the Protestant Catholic divide. I think that when Reason and Theology started, we saw so much of the Catholic Protestant, treatments in YouTube world that we thought that, you know, the Orthodox East and West issue deserved attention. So anybody who's interested in that kind of thing, you know, that's the bailiwick of Reason and Theology.
No, and I really do enjoy the channel. I'm not just saying that. I watch it. Well, my wife can attest. I watch it all the time. She's like, coming into the room. He goes, let's watch something else. Okay, let's watch The Office or something. Well, let's talk about your book. I hear you're writing a book. What's it about?
Yeah. So, yes, I'm working with the publisher, you know, obviously trying to get the book, the page number down. You know, the shorter it is, the more people would be interested in buying it. But, the working title from my end is The Papacy, Revisiting the Debate Between Catholics and Orthodox. And so really what I do in that book is, as the title says, revisiting, because there have been authors that have tried to address the issue. For example, Father Adrian Fortescue, Father Klaus Schatz. There's been other books written on the issue. But I think that the Orthodox, a lot of their objections, especially the strong ones, were not always known due to the fact that they weren't translated into English. Mass communications were not as prevalent. I think that they've done a lot of homework in answering Catholic arguments, and I think that it deserved a new treatment, okay. Now an updated treatment. And so the book is not as, you know, so some listeners may think, oh, this is like the Catholic, you know, defense of the papacy. It is, you know, but it really is a balanced view. I think that in the fight between the Orthodox and the Catholics over the papacy, it's not like a Mike Tyson first round knockout. It's definitely the older 15 round, you know, shebang. And I think the Orthodox land a lot of clean shots. I mean, and it could be to the point where, you know, the judges have to rewatch the video of the fight. I try to be as fair and balanced as I can, but I do think that the Catholic Church wins, even if by the hair of a weight, the weight of a hair on a micro balance. I still think the Catholic Church wins the debate, and I explain why. But, you know, as readers go through it, they may be awestruck that, you know, sometimes I make some major concessions that, you know, the Orthodox have a point in some things that they say.
Right. Do you have a release date yet or not quite yet?
No, I wish I did. I really wish I did. I don't. It's soon, I'm hoping, but I don't have a release date.
Well, you have a lot on your plate with family, school, so you're doing a lot. So,
yeah.
Eric, how can our listeners get a hold of you if they wanted to learn more about you?
Yeah, so ericybarra.org, that's ericybarra.org. You can go there. I still, you know, regularly write articles. Or you can see, you know, look for Reason in Theology. I might be on there. I actually created my own YouTube show, but I haven't even done episode one yet. I probably won't do a first episode for a while. There is two videos uploaded from years ago, but it's called Classical Christian Thought on YouTube. You might subscribe there for future updates. And then I'm on Facebook quite often. So those are the three venues that anybody can reach out to me with.
Great. Well, Eric, thank you for your time today. I know we just scratched the surface, but I really thank you for your insights and thoughts on the subject. Thanks for coming on.
No, thank you for having me.
All right. God bless you.